Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the October-November 2024 issue of Guideposts and begin by finishing with the article, The Pursuit of Happiness. The Pursuit of Happiness, an article by Edward Grinnan, interviewing Harold Koenig. Edward. A friend of mine said that during the pandemic, his family got together for a virtual reunion. Now they're going to have reunions virtually because it's more convenient. And I thought that's kind of sad. Is there something about being in the physical presence of others that is uplifting and psychologically advantageous to happiness? Harold. I'm not sure if that's actually been studied in terms of the physiological reactions to connecting with people in person versus over the internet. Some people are extroverted. They just love to be with other people. Others are introverted. When they're with people, they get worn out. But we need other people. We have not evolved for virtual meetings. Our physiology has evolved in terms of in-person meetings because that's the way it's been for thousands of years. I don't have any data on it, but logically there would appear to be greater physiologic reactions, positive emotions from being in person, being able to hug and touch another person. Edward, I've been asking people what they do to enhance happiness when they get out of bed in the morning. One woman told me she gets out of bed, fills her bird feeder. That sense of duty to other creatures and being able to do something positive soon after she gets up produces real happiness for her. Another person told me he sends an encouraging text or email to someone in his family or circle of friends every morning. Harold, the first thing I do each morning is pray. I meditate on certain scriptures, and in particular, on a devotional called My Utmost for His Highest by Oswald Chambers. Then I start praying for others. While I exercise, I'm listening to the Bible. Then I work 10 hours a day. After I get off the computer, I swim. After that, I spend the rest of the day with my family, with my wife. We have 3 or 4 hours at night to watch TV, to eat, to read, to pray. Edward, do you ever sleep? Harold, yes, 7 to 8 hours. Edward, so many people say they're exhausted. They get up and they're tired. I'm a night person. I feel as if I'll miss something if I go to sleep. Harold, it's important to sleep 7 to 8 hours to be healthy and happy. Sleep is also critical for your cognitive functioning. Edward, one thing that people say that keeps them up at night is the state of our world. It seems rife with negativity. How do you combat that? How does happiness become a shield against it? Not a denial, not an escape, but a way to deal with negativity. Harold, we have 16 hours during the day when we can make a difference in this world. Don't look at media all the time because it is overwhelming. You can pray to God for the war in Israel and Palestine. You can pray for political figures. You can pray for the families of people who have been killed. You can make a difference by doing that. Edward, some people say because the world is such a troubled place, they don't deserve happiness personally. Harold, all of us deserve happiness. It's our choice to walk in a way that will bring happiness. God made some rules and laws in Holy Scriptures of virtually all of the 5 major world religions that talk about moral values. Those rules don't suppress our happiness. They're a guide to happiness. And when we don't do those things, we become unhappy. We may experience momentary pleasure, but over the long term, we end up unhappy. Edward, happiness is rooted in the practice of your personal values, whether they're religious or moral or both, but it's a choice. Harold, I think largely it is, and we can change. The brain is very neuroplastic. It can grow new connections very easily. Our brains are made so that we can adapt to any situation in order to survive. Our choices, behaviors, and experiences can create new connections in the brain. Nobody is condemned to a life of misery. It's going to be harder for some to be as happy as others. The different situations that people are in affect their happiness, no doubt, but the choices you make have an enormous impact on the level of flourishing in life. Edward, so these neural pathways in the brain can develop as negative pathways and your brain starts to react negatively to things? Or if they're positive pathway, your brain starts to react positively to the world? By making good choices, we're actually neurologically conditioning ourselves for happiness and for a happier, positive response to the things that happen to us. Did I get that right? Harold, you absolutely have that right. By our choices, by the habits we develop, which is making the right choice over and over again until it becomes a habit, these create new neural pathways. God's purpose for us was not to make us happy or healthy, but to make us holy. And that just so happens to lead to a naturally abundant life, including happiness. Edward, that's a great way to end our conversation. I'm incredibly grateful for the time you've given me. It makes me very happy. For more on this story, see Family Room. Miracles and healing, active duty. I tried everything for my knee, physical therapy, gel injections, a cumbersome brace, Everything Except Prayer by Christina Moore, Concord, North Carolina. I sat on an examining table in the stark white glare of a doctor's office. I was waiting for some x-ray results. I knew in my heart the results would not be good. For 3 months, my left knee had been the source of unbearable pain. I tried all the usual remedies: rest, ice, elevation, physical therapy exercises. Nothing made a difference. I needed a solution. I was 45 years old, the mother of two very active twin girls. I rarely stopped moving at home. I also was a dedicated runner. I ran 5 marathons the year I turned 40. A wall at my home was covered with the medals, race numbers, and photos of me competing. I love running. It's my stress release, my quiet time, God time. Most of all, being diagnosed with a disabling injury would jeopardize my military career. I was a colonel in the North Carolina National Guard, commanding 4 battalions and coming up on 20 years of service. I was a graduate of West Point on active duty in the Army for 5 years before transitioning to the Guard. My full-time civilian job was providing mobile support for line workers at a utility company. Though my service in the Guard required just 1 weekend a month, plus 2 full weeks each year, being in the military remained central to my identity. Up to now, I managed my symptoms while on duty. I could still meet the minimum physical requirements, but an actual diagnosis would go in my file. At some point, I'd have to appear before a medical review board, which would evaluate whether I could keep serving as an engineer. I couldn't lie about my condition. The board would probably force me to retire. The doctor came in. I realized my palms were sticking to the paper covering the exam table. I prayed silently, but I was so nervous my prayers were barely coherent. The doctor didn't make eye contact as he put the x-ray of my knee on the exam room screen. Not a good sign. I heard him say, "Bone-on-bone arthritis, and no way to save the joint as it is." He stood right next to me, but his voice sounded as if it came over a great distance. I looked at the image. There was no denying it. The cartilage that cushioned the knee joints was simply gone, completely worn away. The bones were grinding against each other. No wonder my knee hurt so much. "I'm surprised to see this at your age," the doctor said. "This could be the x-ray of someone decades older than you. Ordinarily, I'd recommend knee replacement. You're too young for that. You would probably need another surgery in 10 years. Probably another one after that, depending on how active you are." There was an awkward silence. "There's nothing else I can do?" I asked him. "No running, that's for sure," the doctor said. "I recommend a full hip-to-knee brace, worn as close to 24 hours a day as possible. Limit your activity. I'm afraid you'll have to transition to a more sedentary lifestyle." There had to be a mistake, some way out of this. I was a runner, a mom with 8-year-old twins to keep up with, a strong, competent soldier. How could this be part of God's plan for my life? The doctor settled on a 2-prong approach. I would get a gel injection in my knee to cushion the joint and dampen the worst of the pain, a temporary fix. I would also wear the brace, which would partially immobilize the knee, slow further damage, and hopefully buy time before I needed surgery. Crying, I left the office. I wore the brace in the house that evening and hated it. My gait was awkward and stiff. I couldn't run around with my girls. They gave me hugs, but I could tell they wished I could play with them the way I normally did. Later that night, alone with my husband Rob, I let my true feelings show. He was a retired Army major and would understand my sense of loss, of hopelessness. "What am I going to do?" I cried. "I can't hide this forever. I'm losing everything I love. I don't want a sedentary lifestyle." Rob held me and we prayed together. I wish those prayers could be enough. My first weekend back with the guard, I managed to fit my uniform over the brace and move as little as possible to minimize limping. No one seemed to notice. That was a relief. I couldn't do the same thing at work. No baggy uniforms to hide the cumbersome brace. Everyone was kind and supportive. I still hated the brace. Just having it there made it impossible to ignore my diagnosis. Unless you're a runner, it's hard to understand what it's like to lose that daily stress release, especially when it gets taken away from you suddenly. The first weeks were almost impossible. My body was twitchy. I was irritable. I missed my solitary time with God each morning. I heard of soldiers who had joint replacements, then continued to serve. Should I just ignore my doctor's advice and get the surgery? The minute I told someone I needed surgery, though, I would be in front of that medical review board. I was an engineer. I'd have to pass a fitness test. Could not pass that test in my current condition. I continued to pray, though I didn't dare ask for healing. I'd seen the x-ray. Bone-on-bone arthritis just doesn't magically vanish. Better to ask for discernment. I would need help finding a way forward. One morning I was having breakfast with a dear friend. I told her about my knee and all the fear and depression that followed. She nodded sympathetically, but then she gave me an earnest look. "You should pray to God about this, Christina," she said, "for healing." "Oh, I do pray," I said. "But I saw the x-ray. There's nothing doctors can do except surgery." "That's not what I mean," my friend said. She reminded me about something she told me before, how years ago she had been diagnosed with a rare muscular disorder. It had caused all her muscles to fire uncontrollably. You couldn't tell there was a problem from the outside, but it affected everything. It made getting pregnant a huge risk. There was no cure. "I remember you telling me that," I said. "What did you do?" "I prayed. I asked God for full and complete healing, just like that." "And?" I said. My friend looked at me squarely. "God healed me. My condition disappeared. The doctors couldn't explain it. I'm actually planning to share that story at church as my testimony." My mother-in-law sometimes told stories of people she knew who'd been healed. People are healed all the time in the Bible. I remembered how God had comforted Rob and me when we went through an agonizing period of infertility. This was different. Healing my knee would require a flat-out miracle, something science couldn't explain. I had grown in my relationship with God after becoming more committed to Him as an adult. But was I ready to believe in miracles? I wasn't sure. But I was ready to believe. But that night, I couldn't stop thinking about my friend's story. I wanted to believe that the same thing could happen to me. I had to admit I was holding God at a distance because I was too afraid to hope. I closed my eyes. "God, please heal my knee," I said quietly, fully and completely. The next morning, I swung my legs out of bed and stood up. Ouch. My knee hurt just as much as ever. So much for miracles, I thought. I caught myself. That was no way to talk to God. "Thank you for encouraging me to pray," I said. "I'm turning this over to you, God." At once, I felt more peaceful. I got dressed, pulled on the brace, got the girls ready for school, and headed off to work. I prayed for healing and gave the problem back to God the next night. And the night after that, just saying the prayer filled me with serenity. Somehow I knew God was listening. One morning a few weeks later, I swung my legs out of bed and stood up. Was I imagining things or did my knee hurt less? Hard to tell. I put on the brace and carried on like normal. By the end of the day, I was pretty sure my knee was hurting less. It hurt even less the next day and the day after that. The pain medication I'd received with the gel shot had worn off long ago. This was something else. I had a follow-up appointment with the doctor scheduled for 6 months after my first x-ray. I resolved to tell him about my diminishing pain and see what he said. By the day of the follow-up appointment, my knee hardly hurt at all. Was this for real or just wishful thinking? I arrived at the doctor's office and got an x-ray. I waited in the same stark white exam room for results. After a light knock on the door, the doctor came in. He looked at me with a strange expression. He put two x-ray images on the exam room screen. "This is your knee today," he said, pointing to one of the images. "Showed a healthy knee, the bones no longer touching." He pointed to the other image. "That's 6 months ago," he said. "The bones were right against each other." "Nothing we've done so far, the gel, the brace, explains this," he said. "I don't understand it. You no longer need surgery. You don't even need to wear the brace. We're done here unless you have more pain. You can go back to your old life." I walked out of the doctor's office in a daze. I sat in my car and cried. This time, they were tears of gratitude. The doctor had no explanation, but I did. After a lifetime of assuming miracles happen only to other people, I finally let myself believe that one could happen to me. My hope triumphed over my fear, and I dared to ask God for what I truly wanted. I know not everyone receives a miracle when they pray for healing. God's timing is his own, and healing comes in many forms, not all of them physical. For me, the most important change is my understanding of God. I'd always believed that God was present in my life. Now I know he's active. He listens when people pray. He wants to bless you, to heal you. My knee has been pain-free for almost 5 years now. Although I still run, I do more cycling and boot camp these days because those are workouts I can do with my girls. I share my story every chance I get. I encourage people to take their needs to God in prayer and stay alert for his healing work. Miracles are happening all around us. We just have to open our eyes to see. We just have to believe. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. The Power of Forgiveness. The last time I was in prison was to visit my father. I swore I would never go back. Years later, something was pulling me to San Quentin to finally share my story. Not So Different After All, by Gigi Biblow, San Rafael, California. One day about 35 years ago, I stood in line to enter one of America's most notorious state prisons, San Quentin in California. The Power of Forgiveness. The last time I was in prison was to visit my father. I swore I would never go back. Years later, something was pulling me to San Quentin to finally share my story. Not So Different After All, by Gigi Biblow, San Rafael, California. One day about 35 years ago, I stood in line to enter one of America's most notorious state prisons, San Quentin in California. From the front gate, the prison looked like a fortress perched high above the San Francisco Bay. Multi-story cell blocks were guarded by razor wire and surveillance towers. The prison's death row housed dozens of men condemned to die. Today, the prison has been refashioned as a criminal rehabilitation facility, and there's a moratorium on the death penalty in California. Back then, San Francisco housed some of America's worst criminal offenders. It was a fearsome place. Waiting to go inside, all I could think was, why on earth am I doing this? I was a single woman in my late 30s. I volunteered with an addiction recovery organization that sent people into hospitals and prisons to share recovery stories and offer a message of hope. 7 years sober, I had volunteered to join my organization's four-person delegation to San Quentin because I lived nearby in Marin County. Now I wondered if I had other reasons. We showed IDs, passed through the security, and gathered in an assembly area. I took a deep breath. Memories from long ago crowded into my mind. I felt a rising sense of dread. We listened while a guard gave instructions. Do not engage with inmates unless explicitly instructed. Keep yourself focused on what you're here to do and do not attempt to enter unauthorized areas. Your meeting room is on the other side of the yard over there. The guard pointed across a large outdoor exercise yard toward a faraway building. Another guard escorted us out, and we began walking across the yard. I tried not to show my mounting sense of misgiving. We entered a large classroom with about 60 desks in rows. Every desk was occupied by an inmate. They wore denim uniforms and had tattoos visible almost everywhere the denim didn't cover. Many had shaved heads. They stared at us with hardened expressions. Our group stepped to the front of the room and introduced ourselves and the organizations we represented. Foolishly, I realized now I had volunteered to share my recovery story first. I took a halting step forward. I froze. Suddenly, I felt horribly unqualified to inspire anyone. What did I have to offer these men who were so different from me? What in my life experience could they identify with? Entering the prison conjured up long-buried ghosts. These hard men would see right through my recovery. So many wounds remained unhealed. Who was I to tell them anything? The inmates stared at me. I had to say something. My silence was becoming embarrassing. My voice cracked as I began. I should probably start by saying this isn't my first time in a prison. The inmates sat up. Few exchanged glances. I was 7 years old when my daddy was convicted of financial crimes and sentenced to 3 years at Tecapi State Prison near Bakersfield, where we lived, I said. That day changed everything for my family and for me. I sensed interest flickering through the room. I went on. My daddy was a bookkeeper. When he was sober, he could be the best daddy in the world. He was a wonderful storyteller. He could captivate a room and make everybody laugh. But as time went on, he was less and less sober, and he could be really mean when he was drunk. Once, when my 5-year-old sister misbehaved at the dinner table, he yanked her out of the seat, dragged her into the living room, and beat her. Afterward, he slammed her back into her chair and ordered her to eat her dinner. None of us dared say anything. I'll be honest, I was relieved when he went to prison. I knew I should be sad when Mom told me, but lots of good things happened with him gone. We moved into a house owned by my grandmother, and she took care of us. Mom got a job as a school secretary and found a confidence she'd never had when Daddy was around. The only bad part was prison visits. I hated going to that prison. The guards were disrespectful to my mom when they patted her down. It was awkward seeing Daddy. I never knew what to say. A few heads nodded. At last, I continued finding my voice. Daddy came home. As far as I could tell, he was no longer drinking, but he didn't do anything else either. He just sat there. His business was ruined. Neighbors stared when he went out. He was a broken man. One day, Daddy left the house and didn't come back. Police found him in a motel room. He had put a gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. He'd found a way out. I stopped. The room was silent. I remembered my mom crying uncontrollably when the police officers came to our door. I didn't shed a tear. I was 10, I said. I honestly can't tell you how I felt because I buried my feelings. I was the oldest child. Mom needed my help as a second parent, a common pattern in an alcoholic household. Her faith in Jesus kept her going. I wondered if God even cared about our family. My wavering faith collapsed when my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer a few years later. She died when I was 19. I was already married. Mom begged my husband and me to take custody of my 3 younger siblings. Where was God in any of that? I turned my back on him and made a lot of bad decisions. I had tried drinking in high school and didn't like it, but feeling trapped, I turned to alcohol again. I was a terrible substitute parent. My marriage lasted just 2 years. My younger siblings were left to their own devices until a relative stepped in to take them. My drinking became unmanageable. One night, I was driving drunk on my way to celebrate Halloween at a bar. I got sick all over my costume. I pulled over to a gas station to clean up. I looked at myself in the bathroom mirror. There were big bruises all over my body, a sign of alcohol poisoning. I hadn't even turned 30, and already my face looked ragged. Suddenly, staring at my reflection, it was as if I saw my father staring back at me. He hadn't been that much older than I was when he died. His face had that same ragged look, the same eyes devoid of hope. I had been running away from his memory for almost 2 decades. Instead, I had become just like him. In a way, I had put myself in prison, the prison of alcoholism. The next day, I went to a recovery meeting. I had one relapse, but other than that, I've been sober ever since. I let out a breath and scanned the faces of the inmates. Did they sense my lack of confidence? Could they tell my feelings toward my father remained a deep wound? Maybe you're wondering why I'm sharing all this, I said. Well, there's more than one chapter to my story. A few years into my recovery journey, my sponsor told me I was avoiding something. Your father, she said, you need to forgive him. I laughed at her. I really did. I could never forgive what he did to my family, I said. My sponsor insisted, tonight, I want you to get on your knees and pray to your higher power to help you forgive your father. If you don't forgive him, I guarantee you'll drink again. You'll never be free. I was mad about it. I didn't want to do it, but I didn't want to disobey my sponsor. Through gritted teeth, I told God, my sponsor says I'm supposed to forgive my dad. Well, I can't. I'm sorry. If you want me to forgive him, you're going to have to give it to me. At least I was honest, I said as the inmates laughed. But guess what? God was already at work. I went on a retreat at a Christian spiritual center. Remember how I'd abandoned God after my mom got sick? Being in recovery had forced me to spend more time with him, and I was beginning to think maybe he could care about someone like me. During a retreat church service, I had a vision of Daddy, as clear as day. He was in heaven, and he was so happy, like the laughing, storytelling Daddy I'd always wished he could be. I saw God, too. He was looking at Daddy with such compassion and tenderness. I could almost see his love and forgiveness flowing into Daddy and healing him. In that moment, I knew that God's love and forgiveness were flowing into me, too. I forgave Daddy then, and I suppose I forgave myself, or at least I tried to. You know what they say, one day at a time. The inmates laughed again. I'll be honest, I said to them. I was terrified entering this prison today. I was not prepared for how coming here would force me to confront all my doubts and insecurities. Guess what I learned? Sometimes it's the doubts and insecurities that lead to healing. I was so angry at my dad, so ashamed of myself for becoming like him. But the wounds I suffered back then made me stronger now. I'm proud to say I am my father's daughter. If there is hope for me, there is hope for you. With God's love, recovery is always possible. My story ended, and I rejoined the others in my group. The inmates were silent as the next person stepped forward and began their story. I still couldn't tell what they were thinking. With the stories finished, we closed the meeting with a serenity prayer. The inmates clapped politely and rose to leave. Then something remarkable happened. All 60 of those men came straight toward me and began shaking my hand and telling me how much they loved my story. Thank you, they said. You have no idea what that meant to me. Their hardened expressions were gone. In that dark prison, I now saw faces full of light. I had entered San Quentin wondering what I had to offer the broken men inside. I would walk out knowing that my own brokenness was my most powerful witness. What I said to the inmates is true. You may feel imprisoned by your wounds and your bad decisions. God loves you anyway. Turn to him and trust him with your weakness. He will set you free. For more on this story, see Family Room. That's all the time we have today for Guidepost. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.